I take the duty of the Yisker sermon very seriously. I feel that it needs to come from the heart and touch the heart, that it needs to be connected to our universal sense of loss, so that we can come into contact and meet and greet again our loved ones. And that is what I try to do each Yisker. But I can't do that today. I can't do that because once again, our nation has watched shocked as our schools have been turned into killing grounds. It's a story told that when the great Shaul Lieberman, one of the greatest Talmudists of all time, a gentleman who knew the entire Talmud by heart and could perform the pin test in which you could put a pin through any word in the Talmud, and he would tell you what the word on the other side of the Vilna edition was receiving a reward for his contributions to Judaism. And a reporter came and asked, "What are you studying?" This man who had it all memorized was still looking at a block Gemara, at a page of the Talmud. And he pointed and said, "Well, this is the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and it's written about 200. And then down here we have the Gemara, concluded about 550. And on the inside we have Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki from France, 11th century. And then the outside we have his grandchildren from the 12th, 13th centuries. And then if you turn to the back, you've got all the commentaries. You've got Bar-Nura, Rambam, going back through the generations up to today." And the reporter looked at him and said, "So Judaism is a conversation between the generations." And he said, "You know, that's the best definition of Judaism I've ever heard, a conversation between the generations." And one of the conversations I would like to have at a time like this is to ask our loved ones who are not here, why under your watch were there not these sorts of school shootings? What was different about your culture that you could keep your children safe in the schools and that we don't know how to? What has changed? And I wonder about that conversation that Lieberman talked about that we're supposed to have among each other. And I wonder if real, deep, connective conversations had been had between Demetrius and his schoolmates and his teachers and the older generations who were charged with his care. I wonder if anything would have been different then. But I don't know. And that lingering question reminds me of a Hasidic tale. Chassid, and he's busy studying his Gemara. And at a certain point, years he's been studying, he gets fed up and he shuts the book and he goes almost stark raving mad into the center square and he starts yelling and screaming, "What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of life? Somebody give me the answer to the meaning of life or I can't go on." And the Rebbe looks at him and walks up to him and slaps him dead across the face. "Rebbe, why did you slap me? Why would you want to ruin a perfectly brilliant, deep, and eternal question with an answer? Don't you know that it is the questions that unite us and the answers that separate us? It's the questions that unite us and the answers that separate us." And isn't that the case when it comes to how to prevent gun violence and death in our community? That we each carry with us certain certitudes, platitudes about what must happen in order to end the scourge, and that when we do that every single time, we end up divided and unable to make any sort of progress. Santa Fe, Texas had armed guards. It had a somewhat hardened school facility. The students were trained, and you could see the pictures of them properly trained on how to leave an active shooter scene, marching out of the building. What if making our schools more secure won't work? After all, as some of you know, I am the survivor of the school bombing at Hebrew University, which was probably one of the most secure campuses on the planet, with armed guards and metal detectors and turnstiles and high walls, and we couldn't be kept safe there. What if making schools safer isn't the answer? So Demetrius Pagansis used his father's guns. They were in the house. And most school shooters, it turns out, use guns that are in their family or relative's home. So what if better gun control for minors won't work because the minors aren't the ones buying the guns? What if setting up laws to restrict it or raise the age won't change anything because that's not what gets the guns into the hands of these troubled youth? We have 350 million guns in this country, and it could be higher. What if gun control, complete gun control, was implemented tomorrow, but these 100-year devices continue to end up in schools, killing the innocent? What then? And how do we live with that? And then what do we do? What if we tried what a much smaller country like Australia did and bought back those 350 million guns at a price of at least $35 billion? How many people would die because we shuffled that money out of other programs that save lives and care for the indigent and or weakened the support that protects us? How many people would die if we shifted that money? And how would we feel about that then, looking back on it? And what if instead, during such a buyback period or a mandatory requirement to turn in your guns, the gun owners in our country felt threatened that their rights were being taken away and that the government was coming after them? And what if they went into the streets with those weapons and sowed chaos and caused more murder and death and mayhem than all our school shootings combined? Would we have done the good and the moral in that case? Just the other day, Rabbi Isaac and I exchanged a few words about Steven Pinker's marvelous book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, a book that had a profound impact on me. And Pinker gathered every bit of research he could find, thousands and thousands and thousands of studies, going back to Paleolithic burial sites, where we learned that one in three human beings died of blunt force trauma, which means that 33%, one in three people, were murdered by another human being. And Pinker talks about, actually, this is the path of morality in our time, that despite how difficult the world looks, we have improved as a species, such that in Europe, only one in 100,000 people is killed at the hands of another human being. And this drastically more dangerous country, it's 5 in 100,000. So what if the best the human species can do is right now? Because it's a lot fewer than 1 in 100,000. What if we can't make the world better than this? Then how do we live in a world in which evil is a fundamental and unavoidable part of being a human being? How do we carry that? These are not pleasant questions, because we all want answers. Because to relinquish answers is to give up on the possibility of hope, and the human being, more than anything, cannot live without hope. But sometimes, in the cost of buying cheap hope and quick answers, we let the essential questions that bring us together, that keep the horror and the pain of our humanity fresh in front of us. And we have a responsibility, I think, at times, to sit with the questions. Because so long as we sit with the questions, then the lives of those 10 people, those 8 children, those 2 adults, that 1 officer of the peace, those 13 injured that I know about at this time, stay fresh with us. And their loss remains a painful scar on our hearts. And maybe that's part of our responsibility as human beings, to sit in the uncomfortable pain of who we can be at our worst. But we can't stay there either. We have to have that hope. And if there's one thing that history has shown me, it's that when you're in the midst of something really terrible, it looks like it will never end. Our people knew that during the Shoah, when it looked like one unending, absolute, barbarous act after another. But earlier this year, I was fortunate enough to perform the funeral for one of our Russian families, and I was invited back to the home, and the son showed me around his house. And there on one of the walls in his living room were mounted about 10 different Nazi daggers. And I looked at them, and he told me that the part of Russia he came from, the Nazis had made it in. And to this day, you still find the remnants of them. In fact, on the family parcel of land, they discovered that buried underneath the driveway was a landmine that he found as a kid just by digging, and which, thank God, didn't go off. And they came, and they dug it up, and they detonated it. But on his wall are those 10 daggers that the Nazis had to kill people who were innocent. And he said, better they should be on my wall. And they probably thought that they would have those knives forever. But here I am, a Jew, and I have their daggers, and they are no more. Maybe one day, flattened guns will be tacked onto our walls, and we'll look back, and we'll recall that at one point, it seemed impossible for us to ever move past this continuing scourge. One day, because we need that hope after we mourn, after we remember the dead, after we have that conversation that unites those we love who were taken from us. We're going to rise for Yisker.